Today on Rambling About Cars, Hyundai has us hopping. We have a new Elantra N. We finally have Santa Cruz pricing, and that might be surprising for some people. We've got a GTI in America finally to talk about. We've got a fantastic Aston Martin supercar that's hot off the press, brand new. We're also going to talk a little bit about Goodwood. And I have a sad personal automotive story that I'm going to share here later on that I hope everybody sticks around for, because I think it kind of speaks to the core of what it means to be an enthusiast and why we do some of the crazy stuff we do. So, fantastic friends, it's podcast time. I'm Christopher Smith. Across the way is Chris Bruce. Bruce, I apologize if I'm bringing the mood down here a little
bit. No, not at all, but you're stealing my job. I'm usually the one that goes...
The news was a little sad.
I'm usually the one that goes through the news. You're supposed to be saying things like lovers of Lincolns, mavens of motorsport, believers in BMW. Like, they're supposed to be.
I just gave us a little summary.
There's not even a. It's podcast time. Come on, dude. But you're right.
It's podcast time.
We've got an hour in there.
We've got a lot to talk about. Yeah. We got a lot to talk about. Let's jump into it. What do you want to start with?
Let's start with the Hyundai Elantra N.
Hyundai Elantra N.
Yeah, it's not necessarily my favorite of the group, but. We'll start there because I do think it's interesting.
It is. It broke. It has. We're recording this on Wednesday. It broke Tuesday night in America, which would be Wednesday morning in South Korea. Mm-hmm. It was the global debut. Although when we were asking Hyundai for embargoed information ahead of time, they said, "Well, the American version will probably be a little different, so we don't have anything for you."
But it wasn't, okay. Right? Like, I didn't keep a super close track on the South Korean version, but I don't think there were any differences.
I don't think there are going to be any differences unless they rate something a little differently. Sure. I mean, honestly, probably speaking a little inside baseball here, I'm not sure how well Hyundai's U.S. PR people mesh with their counterparts in South Korea. But this was the global debut. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in a foreign language that we had to translate. This is a proper global debut for the Elantra N. The big news here, obviously, 276 horsepower. It's the turbo 2-liter, we've seen a lot.
That's familiar. That's in the Veloster N, and then for our European pals in the i30 N as mm-hmm. well. So that's an engine that's existed before, but until now, you haven't been able to get it into a sedan like this, especially in the United States. So,
right.
You know, for people who want a sporty sedan, I would say the primary kind of competitor against this would be a Jetta GLI. And
I think
you'd have to pick I would pick this over a Jetta GLI every day of the week.
I would as well. I think Hyundai and Kia, they're just killing it right now with style. And this, I mean, the Elantra, there are some people that aren't really fans of it. It's got kind of that goofy
I'm not in love front with
end,
it.
But I've seen these in person, not the end, but the new Elantras, and I think they just look sharp in person. This car available with a 6-speed manual or mm-hmm. dual clutch automatic. More inside baseball. When I was writing this up last night, Hyundai's initial announcement made no mention of the manual, and all along through the teaser,
probably because they don't expect to sell any of them, dude.
Yeah, but it's like, come on, Hyundai, if you're going to announce this, at least get your information right. Because I had the article up and then I was saying, well, wait a minute, maybe there is a manual. And it turns out that they must have done a correction because they changed their whole announcement. Anyways, yes, available with a manual transmission, turbocharged engine, small compact sports sedan. These are getting rare, folks. This isn't going to be a super high dollar machine. We don't know pricing yet. Mm-hmm. Pricing will come later. We don't know when it's going to be available exactly yet. That's going to come later. Presumably, it'll launch in South Korea before it goes to other markets around the world. So, I mean, I would expect to see this probably next year in the United States, 2022. Yeah. They're saying 0 to 60 in 5.3 seconds. It's still front-wheel drive. This isn't all-wheel drive.
No.
This still turns the front wheels. They have a trick electronic differential that helps minimize understeer. Well, what else? They stiffened up the chassis a little bit. They stiffened up the suspension a little bit. If you've heard or seen any of the spy videos we've run on Motor One, where we caught prototypes going around the Nürburgring sounding all poppy and just kind of mean and nasty, Hyundai puts an active exhaust system on here. So you can basically push a button, flip a switch. It could be just a normal kind of silent four-cylinder rolling along, or it can be all gravelly, snappy. And I mean, I kind of dig it. I like it. They also have a sound mode through their infotainment system that'll pump artificial engine sounds of varying degrees into the car, which I think is a little gimmicky.
Totally is.
But I mean, hey, that's
all. A lot of automakers are doing that now. Yeah. Like, that's just kind of the way things are. So you can't totally nail them for that.
And of course, it's available in Hyundai Performance Blue. You can't have an N without that.
I like that baby blue color.
I do. I like it as well. And visually, they don't really do much extra. You've got a small chin spoiler up front. You've got the requisite spoiler at the back, diffuser at the back, wheels. I mean, that's pretty much it.
And as we were talking about this, I was thinking about it. The other one that would compete against this is the new Civic Si that we know is on the way. But 270 plus horsepower on this. We obviously don't know what the Civic's going to have. I wouldn't expect it to be more. And 228 horsepower from the GLI, the current one. So this is it. If you want a compact, sporty sedan, this is going to be the power leader by far. Mm-hmm. I can't think of anything else that is other than those two. Is there another real competitor in this market in the U.S. anymore?
I mean, in the U.S., I'm sitting here. I mean, maybe people would cross shop the WRX, but all-wheel drive, though. I mean, I feel like it's in a different category.
Yeah.
But then again, I mean, power wise, it's probably going to be comparable.
Yeah. Power wise, it would be comparable. Yeah.
I mean, the big question is obviously going to be price, whatever Hyundai decides this thing is going to cost. I mean, I'm interested to see it. I've been a fan of the new Elantra since it came out. The N line has what, like 201 horsepower. So, I mean, this will be a healthy bump up from the N line. I think Hyundai's hitting it.
They've been doing pretty well for a little while. You know, they started with the i30N, which we didn't get, but then they shoved that same engine into the Veloster. Now you're getting the Elantra. We've been hearing rumors forever about a Kona N.
It's coming.
Obviously, I think Hyundai knows that the crossover market is where they're going to make their money, and doing a performance crossover, especially if, you know, this engine is engineered, it's done, they can shove it into stuff. You know, if you could do a Kona N or, you know, a Tucson N or something like that, that's really where they're going to make their money.
I agree. And for what it's worth, I hope Hyundai sells a bunch of these cars, because this is a segment that's dying.
Yeah,
some of us don't want a performance crossover. Some of them, I mean, they're all right, but I'm still a sedan and a coupe person.
Yeah.
Speaking of small cars, you want to jump over to Volkswagen? Because brought this up today. Let me find something up here.
So we finally, and so it's funny to say this, we got confirmation that the GTI and the Golf R were coming to the United States in May of last year. So we are now in July. So it has been over a year for us to get pricing and fully official specs for them for the U.S. market. And it finally came today. So
we have it now.
Yeah, we finally know.
Looking at it on YouTube, $29,549.
Right.
And,
so that's.
And Golf R is a little more.
Golf R is a big more. There's no little about it. So
come on. That's only 14 grand.
Yeah, Golf R starts at $43,645. And both of these numbers we're talking about now are with the manual. Both come with a 7-speed dual clutch gearbox as well. I'm not good enough with subtraction to just tell you, so I will just give you the amount. So a DSG equipped model would be $30,345 for a base GTI, or $44,445. Sorry, that's a lot of fours for a DSG equipped Golf R. But yeah, we finally know. The interesting thing is GTI specs identical to Europe, just straight identical. So you're going to get a 2-liter turbocharged engine making 241 horsepower, 273 pound-feet of torque. And again, you either get the 6-speed or the 7-speed DSG. Golf R is also a 2-liter, but they do some work on it. So you're getting 315, I'm bad with numbers today for some reason, horsepower and 295 pound-feet of torque. The interesting thing is that torque figure. So it's 295 pound-feet of torque with the DSG. If you get the 6-speed, it drops to 280. And the European spec Golf R makes 310 pound feet across the board. And so that's interesting. I reached out to Volkswagen about this, and apparently it's an issue with full fuel quality across the two regions. Europeans get better fuel, so they had to detune it for us. Sorry, America.
You know, I hate to say this, Bruce, but based on previous dealings with Volkswagen, is that something that that we're just ready to accept as fact? I hate to be that guy.
Why else would they do it though? Like,
I mean, how come
I see your point, but
I mean, how come we're not seeing these kind of ratings adjusted with other automakers? I mean, we do see some differences from time to time, but it's like, you know, what's the fuel quality is different. I don't know. That seems like a reach. That's what we were told.
That's what we're told.
We need to explain that. We need to make sure everybody's clear.
I specifically ask because I noticed the difference, and that's what I was told. If you want to spin a conspiracy theory, good on you. But that's the official line, is its fuel quality. I kind of believe them in a way, because, you know, in a lot of parts of the U.S., gas quality does vary, especially various times of the year. You have summer versus winter gas, stuff like that. From 310 to 280, 30 pound feet. That seems like a lot.
A difference of 30 pound feet without any change in horsepower?
I'm sure there's going to be an aftermarket guy who you can plug a chip in and get the 30 pound feet back, because that's probably the only difference, really.
Well, let's be honest. It'll go to a dyno and we'll find out the damn thing makes like 400 horsepower. Sure. the way things go nowadays, right?
That too. Yeah.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah. So, hey, at least the GTI is finally here.
Yep. They will be on sale. Both will be on sale fourth quarter of this year.
Okay.
But yeah, GTI, it still starts at sub $30,000. It did the previous generation too, but I think I looked it up. It's like, it's just shy of $1,000 difference between the previous gen and the new gen. So not that much of an increase. And all of them come with a digital instrument cluster now. So that's kind of high tech. The base model gets an 8.25-inch infotainment screen. If you go up to the mid-range, basically the SE, you get a 10-inch infotainment screen, and that also has navigation, so that's kind of nice. So base model is $29,545 with the 6-speed. The SE is $34,295 with the 6-speed. So about $5,000 difference, roughly.
And you know,
a little less.
That's not much of a price difference year over year, considering you're jumping to an all new model.
I mean, all new model, more power. I have to
applaud Volkswagen for that. It's really, how many people buy the base model? You know,
the base model's coming pretty. I mean, how many base model vehicles right now are coming with a 10.25-inch digital instrument cluster? Like that's a selling point, I think, in VW's favor. I mean, there aren't that many hot hatches around anymore anyway. And VW made the decision that there's no longer going to be the Golf in the United States. So the GTI essentially is the Golf, you could say it that way. Also comes with standard heated front seats and a heated steering wheel. So they're packing a lot of features in for that money.
Yeah, that's not bad. You know, the original hot hatch, once again, like Elantra, I hope Volkswagen sells a lot of these, because it's another dying segment. We're not seeing many cars like this left. Now, let me ask you, Bruce, $43,000 for that Golf R.
That's a lot of money.
Is there something you would rather have than the new Golf R? If you have $43,000 to spend.
Yeah, I'm going to buy a GTI SE, the mid-grade that I just said, for $34,000. So $9,000 less. And yeah, it's going to be front-wheel drive, but I'm going to have LED headlights, a sunroof, adaptive cornering for the fog lights, a 9-speaker Harman Kardon stereo. And granted, all that stuff comes on the Golf R as well, but it's also $9,000 more. I'll just take the mid-grade and be a very happy person.
You know, I bet there are a lot of people thinking that. I've been trying to wrap my head around this one. Admittedly, I've never been a huge Volkswagen fan. I did own a Mark II GTI.
Oh.
So I do understand why people love the GTI. I wasn't expecting to have as much fun with that car as I did. But I mean, at 43 grand, honestly, I'm not even thinking about Volkswagen.
Yeah. And I agree with you, but here's the thing. I'm looking at this new GTI and I'm thinking, I have no intentions of getting rid of my Mini, but God forbid something happens. Someone hits me, something like that. If I needed to replace it, a GTI like SE, the mid-grade, I would be on board with that. I think it has a lot of the features that I would want. It has the size that I would want. Like, I have no problem with that. I agree that the Golf R, 43 grand just feels like a ton of money, especially that's without, you know, it's 44, basically 44.5 with the 7-speed DSG. Like, that's a lot of money. I don't know. But the GTI, I think the price is fine.
Yeah, I would agree on that. Do we want to keep talking about pricing here? Do you want to jump over?
No, I think we should talk about pricing. I think we should keep this train running. Another vaguely affordable vehicle and something that we can kind of debate about. So
well, let's jump over to pricing with the Hyundai Santa Cruz.
That's right. So we finally got pricing info about the Santa Cruz. It debuted earlier than the Ford Maverick, but we got pricing info about the Ford Maverick first. And then we finally got pricing info about the Santa Cruz. So here she is.
And it's surprising. It's about, what, $3,500 more than the Maverick base price. Yes. You're looking at $23,990 base price for the Santa Cruz. That does not include $1,185 in destination charges. That gives you a grand total for an entry-level Santa Cruz, $25,175. And compare that to the Maverick, the base Maverick, with destination included, $21,490. So, yeah, you're looking at a significant difference. I wasn't expecting it to be that far apart, Bruce. How about you? I figured it would be more expensive. I didn't think it would be that much more.
I agree that it's a good chunk. I agree with that. But here would be my counter argument that according to the latest numbers by J.D. Powers, as of June 2021, the average new car costs $40,000, $40,206 to be specific. So we are still talking about a vehicle that is vastly below the average price that people are spending on cars. And I think the fact that we have two compact pickups that you can both pick up for, you know, for in the 20s, I think for if I was a tiny pickup truck buyer, I would be a very happy person trying to decide between these two vehicles.
I mean, I see what you're saying about the average new car price being 40 grand. But I think in context here, we're looking at basically the rebirth of a segment where buyers are extremely cost conscious.
Sure.
I'm not sure the average new car price argument is going to hold much weight with them because these are people that either aren't interested in having a full-size truck or would like to have a full-size truck brand new, but simply can't justify 40 or 50 grand for a decent one. So they're going to look in the compact segment. And when you can get a Maverick for thousands cheaper and you have the credibility that Ford has with trucks already built in, I mean, I think Hyundai might have been better off to try to at least come in with their base model a little bit cheaper. Because let's be honest, the real competition on price isn't going to be that base model. Because how many people are going to spend 21 grand for an absolutely stripped down Maverick? Very few. Most people are going to be mid or upper range, which means mid 20s, around 30 grand. And that's where the competition is really going to heat up. It's a little difficult because as of right now, at least, we still don't have a configurator for the Santa Cruz. So it's very tough to compare Santa Cruz and Maverick apples to apples. The short and skinny of it is we expect the Santa Cruz, it's going to have a lot more in the way of standard features.
Right.
I put together kind of a just a hocked up
I was about to say that. Credit to you because you wrote this story, but you did a side-by-side comparo of what we know now of Santa Cruz trim levels and their pricing versus Maverick trim levels and its pricing. And yeah, it's you're right. The Santa Cruz starts significantly more, but if you look at down at that SEL premium 2.5 turbo versus Lariat, you're only talking about a difference of a few hundred dollars. Granted, the limited Santa Cruz is 40 grand, which feels like a ton of money for a truck this small. I don't know why you wouldn't buy a Ranger or something like that. Anyway, go ahead. But why?
I think you did a most expensive Maverick post. Was that you?
Yep, I did.
The most expensive Maverick was 42 grand.
But that was with a ton of accessories most people aren't going to need.
And here's what we need to know about Santa Cruz. What all does that limited 2.5 turbo come with? Is that pretty much a maxed out Santa Cruz? Because if that is,
yeah,
then if you're going to compare apples to apples, a fully maxed out Santa Cruz with the 2.5 turbo, which I believe is more powerful, if my memory serves me, with the dual clutch transmission, with the ability to carry more in the bed, with the ability to tow more, will be less expensive than its comparable Maverick. So that's where we really need to see Hyundai's configurated. Because when you, and I mentioned this as much in this pricing post, when you look at the stats side by side, I mean, you almost have to assume, like, say, for example, the 2022 Hyundai Santa Cruz SE all-wheel drive. I bet that's probably going to be a fairly popular model. It's the SE, which is the base, but it's all-wheel drive, which people are going to want.
Right.
$26,675. You jump over to the Maverick XL, which will also be the base all-wheel drive. But you can only get all-wheel drive on the Maverick if you upgrade to the turbo engine and Ford's 8-speed transmission, and that's $24,795. So technically, you're going to get a more powerful Maverick with the more desirable, in my opinion, transmission instead of the CVT.
Yeah, I agree.
Still less than the Hyundai Santa Cruz. What does that Ford Maverick XL all-wheel drive come with? I have no idea. I don't have it looked up in front of me.
Yeah.
But I bet just without any options, the Hyundai is going to have a lot more desirable equipment on it. So it's still tough. But, I mean, just looking at these numbers as they are even, we see the gap does narrow as you get more into that mid-range where you're going to see a bulk of the buyers.
I mean, I think the bottom line, at least to me, is that the customer is winning here. Because what's going to happen is that since these are the only two trucks in this segment on the market right now, we are going to have just a knockdown, drag out fight between Hyundai and Ford. Ford obviously has the history of pickup trucks, but I hope Hyundai is hungry enough to want to, you know, take every bit of market share from them that they can. And since this is their first pickup truck, their first real pickup truck in the United States, not like some sort of commercial model, you know, a cab over engine, flatbed type thing, that, you know, I want to see, you know, a fight here, that every time Ford comes out with something new, Hyundai comes out with something new. Just like we're seeing with Bronco and Wrangler, I want to see that same fight in this segment.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was thinking about that and the things that I've said in the past with regards to Jeep and Ford and their Wrangler versus Bronco kind of relationship, where you see Jeep is just completely reactionary right now. They're basically forced to play Ford's game, and it kind of shows in desperation. If you want to see how that works, how it should work on the opposite end, you have Maverick and Santa Cruz, where these are two absolutely competitive vehicles. There is no question.
Oh, totally.
That these are matched up together. Neither side is really, I don't feel like either side is intentionally trying to outdo the other.
They're
just laying their cards down and they're saying, here's what we got. And each side is saying, you know, we think we have the better hand. And that's how you should do it, Jeep. If anybody from Jeep is listening, that's how you should do it. Don't come out with a 392 Wrangler that does 0-60 in 2 seconds, because that's exactly what rock crawling off-roaders want. No. Just lay it out there and bring your best to the table.
So I got to ask you, Which would you buy?
Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz, without question. I think it looks far more dynamic.
I agree. I mean,
even if money is a question, I'm still buying Santa Cruz because one, it does truck stuff better. Sorry, Ford people. The Santa Cruz has a higher payload capacity. It has a higher towing capacity.
But we discussed this. It has a smaller bed.
It has a slightly smaller bed. The bed isn't going to be quite as functional, but I don't really see that being much of an issue for me personally. Right. I think that the bed would be just fine for me. I think the Santa Cruz has a far more dynamic look. I like the idea of Hyundai's turbo with the dual clutch transmission. I wouldn't be thinking of that truck in terms of off-roading. I wouldn't need an FX4 Maverick. I'm thinking of a cool street truck, and Santa Cruz takes it on that. The Maverick is neat, but I think it's really conservative. It's playing to Ford's history. And if Ford just wants to market to traditional Ford people, that's cool. I don't think the Maverick is going to pull in anybody new to the segment, whereas Santa Cruz might.
I think you're right. I think, honestly, if it came down to it, I would pick Santa Cruz as well. This image still bothers me.
That's such a stupid image.
Hyundai, why did you do this? It makes your truck look bad. My truck can't fit a standard mountain bike. Like, that's not a special, like, yeah, it's a nice mountain bike, but
my Mazda hatchback fits a standard mountain bike.
Yeah, that was just a bad move on Hyundai's part.
They're trying to show off that little neat tailgate feature. Hey, look, we have this thing that you could put on your truck that makes it easy to haul your bike.
But
they should have found a better way to market it because, yeah, it looks terrible.
It still bothers me.
But it makes the Santa Cruz's bed look completely useless.
That's the problem.
It's not useless. It's just a little bit smaller than Ford's bed. But I mean, Ford definitely takes the cake for having a more functional bed.
Well, here, before we transit, here's one of the other things I do like about the Santa Cruz, though, is I love this digital instrument cluster on it.
Yeah,
I think it looks great. It looks really high tech. It looks feature forward, especially compared to the Ford. Yeah, I think I would go Santa Cruz. It's a toss up, you know. I think I'm very curious to see how this segment looks in 5 years. You know, does Chevy, does Dodge, does whomever, you know, do they come out with their own tiny pickups to kind of compete against these? Because I kind of think they will, because if they don't, they're leaving money on the table.
Well, that, I guess, remains to be seen whether or not these small unibody front-wheel drive-based trucks sell in America.
Yeah.
And the competition, they're going to be watching these two very closely. I don't think we'll see a competing model from anybody else in the next 2 years, I'll say.
No, that's why I said 5 years. I think 5 years maybe, but
5 years, if these are doing pretty good, the competitors are going to be like, well, okay, let's jump into our overseas bin and let's see what we can import over here post haste.
Exactly.
Because now, Americans are ready for small trucks.
Let's talk about a vehicle neither one of us could afford, even if we combined our incomes. How about that?
Well, even if we combined our incomes and then multiplied it by an nth degree. Now, this is, Bruce, if you have photos available, I'm going to let you handle the photos because I was having trouble with this. This is breaking news for us because we're recording this podcast a day before this incredibly good-looking new supercar comes out. It's called the Aston Martin Valhalla. If that name sounds familiar, there was a concept.
Yeah, I mean, they've been promising it for ages. It's just we're finally seeing the production version.
Yeah, this isn't the concept. This is the production version. It differs a little bit.
Yeah, I'll have images as we go along to show the concept. And it is a bit different. It's not a significant thing. I have some gripes with the name that we'll get to later, but let's get the specs down first. So this thing... it was originally supposed to use Aston Martin's own twin turbo V6 engine. Mm-hmm. They dropped that, and it is now using a 4-liter twin turbo V8. The engine itself makes 740 horsepower. However, as is kind of the standard of these days, this is a hybrid with the hybrid kind of working everywhere. And so total output is 937 horsepower. So that's a significant number.
It's got dual motors, dual electric motors, one for
three motors. Axle.
Well, yeah. The internal combustion engine plus one motor in the front and one motor in the back, electric. Or are there two electric motors?
They are saying three motors. I apologize to anyone watching. We have not written the post on this yet, but they are saying three motors and the engine. So, no, it is a three electric motor system plus an internal combustion engine.
Okay. Wow. Well, that does it even better.
Yeah.
So that's 0 to 62. They're saying we haven't written this up yet, folks. I'm looking at the press release right here. 0 to 60, they're saying in 2.5 seconds.
Does 738 pound feet of torque, which is 1,000 newton meters, which is a beautiful big number to see.
I hate to say it, Bruce, but does 2.5 seconds, and technically that's 0 to 62, 0 to 100 kilometers an hour,
same difference,
2.5 seconds, does that feel a little slow? I mean, it's ridiculous to say it. It's not slow, but when you're talking about an all-wheel drive hybrid hypercar with near as makes no difference, 1,000 horsepower.
It
seems slow, a little slow
is a relative word, but well, I'm glad. Let me. So I wrote up a story this week. Mm-hmm. Some guys in the UK, they had a 1997 Benetton Formula One car, and they took it up against a Tesla P100D, not a Plaid, not the brand new model. Mm-hmm. This would be the top model of a couple of years ago, and the F1 car beat it in a quarter mile, but barely. And comparing the times, a Tesla Plaid actually would have beat the F1 car from the late 90s. And we are living in a different world right now where, the numbers we've been seeing from a Tesla Plaid are right around the 2.5. Apparently, if you have it on a perfectly prepped track, it can even be kind of high twos. So, 2.5 seconds now, it does feel a little bit slow. We live in weird times.
It's completely absurd. And the only reason I'm saying that is because bench racers out there by bench racers, I mean the Tesla people. They're going to come and say, well, I can get a Plaid that goes to 61.9 seconds, and I can get that a lot cheaper than the Valhalla. And the point you just made with the F1 car, we're talking about completely different genres of performance. I can strap a Jado pack to my Mazda 6 and smoke, literally, because it's a rocket engine, smoke any Tesla, Plaid, green, purple, anything that you want. There's always going to be something faster in a straight line. Of course, the Valhalla isn't just about going fast in a straight line. This note here in their press release caught my attention particularly. Right after they say 0 to 62 in just 2.5 seconds, in terms of outright track capability, and this is noteworthy because this is going to be really what this car is all about. Aston Martin is targeting a 6-minute, 30-second lap around the Nürburgring Nordschleife. That's
Nordschleife.
Sorry. I always called it Nordschleife. I know Nordschleife, the big track in Germany for those who aren't familiar with it. 6:30 is, I mean, that would be a record for a production car. It boggles my mind to think that not too long ago, 6 minutes, 11 seconds was the record outright for anything, race cars, production cars. And now production car is looking to dip down to 6:30.
To put that number in perspective, so that Mante Racing 911 GT2 RS, which is, it's not really a production. It's a production car that then Mante Racing added stuff to.
You can order the add-ons and have them put on.
Correct.
You can't just go down to a Porsche.
Did it in 6 minutes, 43 seconds. Mm-hmm. So we're talking another 13 seconds quicker than that, which is just, like you said, that's just stupid quick.
Nürburgring records are a double-edged sword for me because one end, it really does showcase all around performance of a vehicle. On the other hand, the track is so stinking long.
Yeah.
One small mistake in one area can really throw off what you think is a fast car or a slow car. You know, it's a double-edged sword. In any case, 630 is a target. Whether they achieve that target is another story.
Sure.
Bruce, what do you think about this hybrid having an all electric range of 9 miles?
Yeah.
I mean, bravo Aston Martin for making the effort.
Yeah. Like, but you know, it is what it is. Like
you can drive it on electric only power. Also, yeah. It's front wheel drive. So now your mid-engine, presumably million-dollar hypercar is front wheel drive.
But you can understand why they're doing this, because in certain cities, especially in Europe, there are now congestion fees where if you are an electric vehicle, you aren't exempt from them. So if you can drive into the city on electric power, you don't have to pay whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Now, to me, that kind of feels like nickel and diming the issue, because if you have enough money to buy this car, pay the friggin' congestion fee. Like,
pay the fee, whatever, yeah.
Whatever it is, like, you've clearly got the money on hand, but well, regardless.
Here's another interesting question, though, because we know many cities, and even the European Union now, they're targeting zero emission completely.
By 2035.
For the EU 2035. But, I mean, some cities are going even earlier than that. So. Yeah. Can you drive into one of these cities where presumably these cars won't be allowed in the future?
With
electric only power. And what if you get in there and you drain your battery and now you're stuck there until you can get it charged back? Well, I mean, plug in a hybrid, presumably you're only getting 9 miles,
right?
Right. You plug it in for 15 minutes and then you go.
Yeah, that all of that part is beyond me. I think a lot of this is just simply a concession to basically being legal under the written rule, but not kind of the way the rule is intended. I think it's more that than actually trying to be clean and green and that type of thing. But yeah, it's a new Aston Martin. Let me do my quick spiel that, you know, this is the Valhalla, and it slightly bothers me because in Nordic mythology, Valhalla is the place where, like, Odin selects half of the warriors to go there, and the Valkyrie take them there. But in the Aston Martin lineup, the Valkyrie is ahead of the Valhalla, so it doesn't make quite... They're good marketing languages, and Aston Martins are supposed to have V's in their name, but they should have swip-swapped them, because the Valhalla should be the ultimate one, and then the Valkyrie should be the thing taking you to Valhalla. That's my nerdy thing done.
You're thinking about this too hard, man. Look at it.
Oh, I totally am. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you should go to YouTube to see this. I think it looks stunning. I think it looks fantastic. I first saw this just probably an hour and a half ago as we're recording. And our global editor in chief, John Neff, shared the photos, as we were putting them up to our card to have the article written. And I was just kind of floored, and it's been a while since a car just absolutely floored me from how it looks. We don't know how it looks inside yet, but I mean, from the outside, if anything, those rear vents going into the feeding the engine there at the back, that might be a little over designed, but there's no mistaking it for an Aston Martin. They really, I mean, for a mid-engine hypercar, they managed to capture Aston Martin's style, and bravo. And Chevrolet, you could have taken a clue from them for the Corvette.
Maybe. So just real quick, people, I promised you this. So we have seen the Valhalla before. The image, if you're watching on YouTube, that's it now. So that's the Valhalla concept on the right and the Valkyrie on the left. So hypercar and supercar, very similar looks. They've basically gone to this kind of super kind of, bulbous isn't the right word. It's flowing, I guess, rounded.
Very organic.
That's a good way of saying it.
Very organic. And I don't think the production version has that same kind of organic quality, to be honest.
Not, it's still there.
I really don't. It's there. Yeah, it's there, but it's tamed down.
Yeah. Well,
it's tamed down. Well, okey-doke. That's going to do it here for our new news of the week. Bruce, we didn't have any emails or commenters.
We had no comments. And that, as always, that makes me sad because I want to read your comments. I want to hear your comments. You know, podcast@motorone.com is the yep. email address. Motor One Podcast is the YouTube address. And you can always find our post every Friday at motorone.com. And we love seeing your comments, positive, negative, thoughts, opinions, whatever. We love seeing them. And no one sent us any this week. So,
and to be clear, we know that you're listening. We know that you're watching.
Oh, yeah. We've got the numbers.
We've got the numbers. We're actually really excited that our move to the new YouTube channel, Motor One Podcast, been doing really well. Folks have been finding us. You've been following us. Please keep it up. If you haven't, YouTube, Motor One Podcast, go there, like, and subscribe. Instead of listening to us, you can actually see us. And sometimes I even drink hot sauce.
That's happened.
On the screen. We're actually going to start a new promo campaign really soon where we have that clip. So a few things bad happened after that program, but hey, it's all for the name of viewers. Bruce, I do have something that I want to read that came to me a couple weeks ago in email. This wasn't related to the podcast, but I want to mention this. I want to point this out. I want to read this because it happens a lot in our business. I think it happens a lot in a lot of businesses where you have public facing figures. But the end result doesn't happen that often. And I kind of wish it did. So let me just jump into this here. This is an email that came directly to me from just a person named Rick.
Yeah.
This is in reference to a news article that I wrote about the second quarter sales of automakers, specifically talking about how the Ford F-150, the Ford F-Series, had a huge dip the last
for
quarter.
Q2 specifically.
For second quarter. And it was beaten second quarter by both Ram and Chevrolet. And that's kind of a big deal. Now, I want to be clear, and I was clear in the headline on this article, that Ford is still, they're still in the lead year over year and year to date. But for the second quarter specifically, the F-Series sales were beaten by Ram and Chevrolet. And the person named Rick had this to say. Absolutely hate misleading headlines like this saying Ford is losing, then reading on that they still lead. Pure crap. You know what? I better pull up this article really quick. Just so I can let people know what the actual headline was. Kind of vamp for me here a little bit, Bruce.
Here, I can probably get, but yeah. You know, the interesting thing is in the past, kind of, basically Tesla started it. They started releasing their sales figures quarterly, and then a bunch of automakers, larger automakers, followed suit. So now it is kind of becoming, rather than getting monthly sales information, which we still do from some automakers, but now the quarterly numbers are a much bigger deal because that's when we're getting that information.
Right. And here's the article specifically that I wrote, and it's kind of complicated because if Ford was reporting quarterly, then they switched back this year to reporting monthly. So when all was said and done, Ford F-Series loses to Ram and Silverado in Q2 2021 sales battle. That's the headline for the article I wrote.
And specifically, Q2 is April, May, June, correct? Because we got the numbers July 1st?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, so April, May, June. Rick didn't like the headline. He said it was misleading. But 14 minutes later, Rick emailed me back, and he says this. Reread headline and I was wrong. My bad. Because I did specify Q2 2021 as opposed to Ford loses to Ram and Silverado. And actually, Rick, I really want to thank you for that email, for both emails. Leading up to this article, we were having a question on what the headline should be because, surprise, folks, in the news world, we need to have catchy headlines because when you click on an article, it sort of goes into our paycheck. We need you to visit us and read what we have to say.
But we have to balance that with being accurate.
We have to be accurate. We have to be honest. There are a lot of places out there that love the clickbaity headlines. It's a fine line to ride, I'm really, really proud of everybody at Motor One because we take that very seriously. And we had some debates for a while on what this headline should read. And another issue is we only have so much space in which to try to convince you to take a look at this article. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was actually a version of this headline that didn't specify this was Q2 2021. And we hashed that out and we said, no, we need to be clear because Ford is still technically in the lead here so far for the year. But I tell you what, if they have another bad quarter, they're in real trouble. Now, the issue here is the chip shortage that has a lot of Ford trucks sidelined while Chevrolet and Ram are still able to sell. Anyways, Rick, you caught that headline, and I know that it kind of shocked you the wrong way. And we get a few emails from time to time of unhappy readers. Very seldom do we get an email, a follow-up email saying, oh, hey, I just realized I kind of caught this mistake here. Sure. My bad. Rick, thank you very much for being a Motor One reader. Thank you for taking the time to send us emails. And let this be known to everybody listening out there. podcast@motorone.com. We do listen. We do read, good or bad. And we want to hear from you. Yeah, I wanted to share that because that was a big deal.
And just to expand on that real quick, so at the bottom of every story that we publish, you will see a banner that says "Send us tips at MotorOne.com." Yep. And the way that actually works is we see the headline that you are responding to. So if you send us a tip, it's not just a random tip, in the ether. We understand where that's coming from, and we get whether it's corrections or just people having opinions. I got one today about a story I wrote that was actually interesting information that I can't necessarily share here because I need to talk to some people, but we get really good information from that. So if you read something and you send us a tip from that link on the bottom, just know that, we read those. We very often respond to those unless, there are some crackpots out there. Sorry.
just a few.
There are some, it happens, but
I don't need any help with my car warranty. I want to make that clear right now.
Yeah. But
unless you want to warranty a 16-year-old Mazda, man,
you need it.
The last year. I need it from the last year.
But anyway, so just to make clear, cause that's where that email came from, is the tips. That mm-hmm. Just want to throw
Rick didn't email tips. Rick took the time to find Rick took the time. That's right. Rick's got to go on. He took the time to find me specifically.
Okay.
Emailed me to let me know that he hates clickbait headlines. Rick, okay. I hate him too, man. Yeah. And we're gonna work very hard to not let that happen with Motor One. Let's talk about Goodwood a little bit.
Yeah, let's talk about the Goodwood Festival of Speed. I have never been just, there. You yep. Have you been there?
I have never been out of North America, man. Okay. I've been all over North America, but I haven't been out. I need to get my international cred here.
Certain our boss Brandon Turkus has been there. I know he went to the Goodwood Revival, but I think he has also been to the Goodwood Festival of Speed. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, yeah. But yeah, let's talk Goodwood.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was last weekend. I mentioned last week in the article that we talk about a little bit. There were some interesting things that happened. I'll be honest. I'm not overly interested in the shootout anymore. And I wonder how many people really are. What I generally watch more often than not are just the exhibition runs, usually on Thursday, Friday. I know they're doing some qualifying runs in there. Just a chance to see some of these incredibly rare, incredibly expensive vehicles that you might never see out in public, and they're out just giving it the beans going up this classic, wonderful hill. I'm trying to think of some of the cars that I saw. I mean, there were some,
it's old, everything. Old it runs Alphas, the gamut.
Some old Alpha, I mean, like race cars, the electric stuff. And like you just said, Bruce, the competition itself, I mean, when you look at the top results here, I've got the list pulled up here from the shootout. Like I said, I'm not really that interested, but I mean, look at the cars that are in the top 10 here. Number one was a McLaren 720S GT3X. It did the climb in 45.01 seconds. That was Rob Bell driving that. Then second place is Travis Pastrana in his Gymkhana Subaru WRX STI. He did it in 46.2. So, okay, McLaren 720S GT3X and a Subaru WRX STI. Hold on, it gets better because Jeremy Smith was third, Spice Cosworth SE88, fourth, Harry King and a Porsche 911 GT3 Cup, fifth, Jake Hill and a Nissan Skyline GTR R32.
I mean, by HKS. Yeah.
HKS. I mean, it just, I mean the mix, and this is why I love watching Goodwood so much. Praga R1 in sixth, Escort Cosworth in seventh, Sauber Mercedes C9 in eighth. What was it? 52.27 seconds. Rick Wood in a Holden Commodore 53.1.
Which that must be like an Australian V8 yep. supercar model, because yeah. there's no way it's a stock Commodore.
But Rory Butcher in a Toyota Corolla. That's an A in the end, Smith. Toyota Corolla, British touring car, 53.89 seconds. I mean, what a mix of cars in the top 10. What kind of interested me this year, the fastest electric car, unless I'm missing something, was 14th. And with the electric revolution that we've been seeing, to see a fully electric car not even in the top 10, it's kind of surprising. For the record, 14, Richard Westbrook in the Mustang Mach-E 1400. We've certainly seen that car quite a bit. Interesting note, Ford's CEO, Jim Farley, drove that car at Goodwood. I was hoping that he was going to do just like a really hardcore full-on blast because, I mean, he does have racing experience. He still races, even though he's the CEO of Ford. I was a little disappointed. I saw his run, and I mean, he wasn't slow, but it felt really more like an exhibition than anything.
Sure.
And I was really hoping to see a little bit more, but I mean, man, that's just the mix. Bruce, do we have any clips or anything footage of some of the crashes? So
that I
because I know they're
asking me that.
There's one infamous crash.
Yeah,
that
and the video I will be sharing an image. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you've got an image, but the video seemed to disappear. Right.
Right. So Goodwood is, let's call it, protective of their videos that they put up. Mm-hmm. So that is why, unfortunately, while we would love to show you some of these videos, we can't. We just can't. Sorry. Like, I want to. I really, yeah. really want to. And specifically, there was a crash this year by a Jaguar XJR 12D. And so I was actually doing a little bit of research on this car before our show tonight. So the XJR 12, that won Le Mans in 1990. The D specifically was the development car. And so while most XJR 12s had covered rear wheels, you can see this one does not. It also had a different wing. There was kind of some changes like that. It was the development car. And as you can see by the image we're showing you, it had some issues with some hay bales
A pretty big off. That's
what I love most about this image that if you're watching on YouTube now, and I'm going to zoom in on it, is the man on the left who is covering his mouth in shock as to what he's seeing. It's blurry, but I can clearly see just a man
oh my.
With some short hair, just like covering his mouth. Like, my God, what's happening right mm-hmm. now?
That's a vintage. That's oh, a yeah. vintage, amazing, expensive race car.
That's a one of one, I would I don't think they made more than one development car of the XJR 12. So that's an expensive mistake is what we're going to call it.
Yeah, that. I mean, they said it was irreparable for the event. I'm sure it'll be put back together for just to get it back on the road. But yeah, that was a major off. And honestly, at Goodwood, we really don't want to see that. I mean, think about this. I'm going to go down a little bit of a dark road here, and I apologize. But how many people watch NASCAR for the wrecks? How many people watch F1 or any, or I guess you're not really watching F1 or Indy so much for the wrecks, but I mean, there are a lot of racing series where you're watching not really to see who wins or their racing technique. You're watching to see a wreck, right? I mean, that, like it or not, there are a lot of people out there that's really what they're wanting to see. And Goodwood, that's not what it's about at all.
Oh no, not at all. Can I build on that a second though? Because yeah. I think there's something interesting there is that, so kind of, at least in our realm, the vintage races that we cover are Goodwood and maybe the Monterey Historics every year. And it's interesting that we don't see these types of crashes in Monterey that often, especially stuff of kind of this magnitude. There's something interesting about the folks that take their stuff to Goodwood is, you know, this guy was going up the hill climb. It's not like he was literally racing, you know, wheel to wheel, fender right. to fender with another car. This was just a mistake on the hill climb that caused this incident. And we see them year in, year out. Goodwood actually, you know, just to promote their YouTube channel, they kind of over the course of the year, they'll divvy stuff up and put up the races. Mm-hmm. And the folks that take their cars to Goodwood, they race them hard. It's not,
yeah.
you know, it's not necessarily, you know, rubbing his racing type stuff, but the folks that are there are out to win, you know, within the idea that this is a $1 million car. That whereas if when you kind of stop watch stuff from Monterey, it's a bit more of a procession, a little bit more like the guys are racing, but no one wants to really wreck anything.
Right. Well, it's bad enough if you wreck your own car. You don't want to wreck somebody else's.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's really what it comes down to when you're on Goodwood and it's just you and the track and the clock.
Right.
You know, it's like sit down, buckle up and let's go.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, you don't want to bend your own car, but when it's just you on the line, you're going to push a little bit harder. And yeah. that is so awesome to see. Think about all the vintage 911s that go up the hill.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's just constant opposite lock with those cars. All of the old like 30s race cars. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're leaning. It's opposite lock. They have just the little skinny tires. You know, some of the guys put on the goggles. God, I'd love that stuff. I agree. See them out there just pushing to the limit. You know what? Hey, we get up the hill in a minute. It doesn't matter if you get up the hill in a minute when the fastest car does it in 45 seconds. If you get to the hill and you're smiling, that's an awesome time.
Oh, yeah.
I'm certainly going to be watching. I mean, I didn't get to watch nearly as much Goodwood as I wanted to. I was watching, you know, some of the clips on Thursday, some of them on Friday, a lot of the exhibition stuff. But, you know, as we were talking about before recording, Bruce, do the results really matter? I mean, yeah, if you win, it's a prestigious thing. But for the viewer, are they really that interested in the results or just the experience?
No, I think, you know, there's bragging rights in the winning. I am the fastest car up the Goodwood Hill. But the Goodwood Hill, it's not an especially challenging course or anything like that. It's really for the people that are there. And if you watch any of the videos from the hill climb, there are people cheering. It doesn't matter if, like, you know, there are years where guys like Travis Pastrana just go up and just slide the whole way up and just yep. are doing donuts and stuff like that. And they're not trying to set a fast time, but the crowd is still cheering and yelling and stuff like that anyway, because that's who it's for. It's entertainment. And that's what, you know, ideally kind of cars should be. There's certainly a place for racing, but in an event like this, you're kind of celebrating the automobile in every way it can be, whether it's electric and just kind of howling up the road, or whether it's a 1920s whatever and it's you and a co-driver, because the co-driver has to be there A, in case the car breaks down, or B, to, you know, lubricate some piece or whatever. So yeah,
you know, that's a very poignant way maybe to move on to this next segment, unless you have anything else to say about.
I don't. This is all you, but I dedicate Goodwood. This one to you, and I will. Maybe I'll make a couple jokes, but this one's all you, man.
No, hey, make the jokes, make the comments, and I'm honestly serious here, folks, because I did get some news earlier this week from a friend of mine. Thankfully, he is okay. His family is okay.
That's the important part. Let's be honest.
I had a car for 1 year. and I sold it to him.
You only had that car for a year?
I only had it for 1 year.
Oh, the way you talk about it, I thought it was around for ages.
Oh, it's been around.
Right, okay. But I thought you had it for a long time. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I only owned it for a year. Back in 2015, I still just had the urge and the itch to buy every single used car on the planet. So to do that, I had to move on.
Sure.
The car was unfortunately burned in the fires that are just raging in the West Coast right now. He's in California. As he explained to me, the fire went from like 2 miles away to his backyard in an instant.
And this happened Monday or over the weekend?
I found out about it on Monday. It happened over the weekend. Then let me tell everybody about the car, because and stick with me here for a moment, because this truly is a special car, even though you might have an initial reaction. The car was a 1987 Mercury Sable LS station wagon. Now,
but
that's going to be unremarkable to everybody. But this car was honestly special because it had the engine and transmission from the first generation Ford Taurus SHO, the 3-liter double overhead cam V6, 5-speed manual. That's still not really what makes it special. This car was purchased by a mid-level Ford engineer in the early 90s, 1990 or 1991, if I remember correctly. That person also bought a wrecked 89 Taurus show, and he did this conversion. Now, he's a mid-level Ford engineer. He was in Dearborn, and he did this conversion using every single factory correct Ford part that he could get. Being an engineer, he apparently had access to things that were still in development, and he built this car, in my opinion, the exact way Ford would have built an actual Taurus show station wagon. The parts were all, I mean, just right down exact. If I remember correctly, he had to fabricate, I think, two specific parts under the hood that didn't quite match up between the Sable and the Taurus. But when I bought the car in 2014, it came with a stack of paperwork, probably 3 or 4 inches thick, that chronicled this gentleman's build. And I mean, this paperwork had all the receipts from Ford dealers where he bought Ford nuts and bolts even to make this thing. I mean, there was no expense spared. The paperwork had engineering schematics, drafting schematics. The car had the rod shifter done to it. That's not going to make any sense to non-show people. The original 89-90 Ford Taurus SHO had a cable shifter. It wasn't that precise. So Ford was developing a rod shifter that would eventually come out in 1991. He had the schematics for the rod shifter and put the rod shifter on it. He built this right as the time the rod shifters were coming out. So, I mean, there was stuff like from the Atlanta assembly plant where the Tauruses were being built. The history on this car, having that knowledge of how it was built, is what made the car just immensely special. That it was done by a Ford engineer using every single Ford nut and bolt he could find. I can only imagine him driving this car up and down Woodward in the early 90s, just humiliating the crap out of the Mustangs and the Camaros. I mean, like the automakers did back in the 60s and the early 70s before the muscle car era really died. I mean, of course, the automakers would take out prototypes. They would take out test vehicles. They would cruise that 25-mile stretch up and down Woodward there outside of Detroit. I can only imagine him cruising up there in this 87 Mercury Sable station wagon, and he kept it. He kept it looking bone stock outside there. I mean, he didn't put any badges or anything on it. It looked like an 87 Sable wagon, but it had 3 pedals and 220 horsepower and would smoke the heck out of the tires. So the history on that car was fantastic. I can't remember his name, but I know he sold it to a friend of mine in Michigan who had the car for a few years. It had sat for a while. So my friend is a mechanic in Michigan. He actually did a lot of mechanical restoration on the car and drove it he even used it as a daily driver for a couple years. And then he wanted to sell it. And this is shortly after I moved out from Michigan to South Dakota. and he wanted to sell it, and he had it for sale for a while, and I kept looking at it because I always wanted – I've had a dozen shows over the years. I always wanted a wagon. So finally, I had to go back to Michigan. I was still working remotely for a company in Michigan. So I said, well, I've got to come into town for business. How about I buy the car and I drive it back to South Dakota? And I did, and that was in 2014. I bought the car. I flew into Michigan for work, bought the car, drove it back out to South Dakota. It occurs to me as I'm talking, I've got a bunch of pictures to share with you people. Let me get some pictures going up here.
Did you know Ford Authority wrote about you and your show wagon?
Yes. Do you know how they wrote about me?
I don't know.
Because I wrote about me. So short, just as I was selling this car, you're getting ahead of me, Bruce.
I'm sorry.
And by the way, that Ford Authority picture, that's not the car.
Right. But it does say
that's just a generic photo. No,
Autoblogs, Christopher Smith.
Before I came to Motor One, I was just doing a little bit of freelance work on the side, and Autoblog had a thing, Car Stories, I think it was called. And I really appreciated the car, and I thought, well, I'll write up a story for Autoblog for Car Stories. Mm-hmm. Here's the actual car. That was after I did some work to it. I bought it in 2014. The exterior still looked very stock, and it needed a little bit of help inside and out, but it was running and driving good. So I bought it in 2014, road tripped it from Michigan out here to South Dakota. And then over the course of the next year, I did some body work. I did some paint work. I did some repair work on the inside. Do I have
that? Did those wheels come with it? Because those are fantastic looking wheels, especially
those wheels did not. This is a shot of, I had to replace the headliner, and it had an aftermarket moonroof installed. So I was basically just kind of freewheeling it on the headliner. Mm-hmm. But I had to replace the headliner, so I did that. No, it came with a set of Thunderbird Super Coupe wheels, if you can believe it.
Okay, I know what those are.
Do I have a photo in here of that? I don't. Oh, yeah, right there.
Yeah.
That was a shot. That was a shot.
Throwing star kind of wheels.
That was a shot. I didn't just park it in my garage. I drove it out here. I wheeled it up. My wife and I went out for picnics in it. It had it had a very rare option of having like a little fold out gate at the back, with like built in cup holders and stuff for picnics. So yeah, we would go out to the country, for picnics. I fixed it up. There's a shot of road tripping it back. Oh, look, there's the Mackinac Bridge in the, connecting the upper and lower peninsula of Michigan in the background. Yeah, I had to have the marker light duct taped on because that was a little loose. But I mean, the car wasn't in bad shape.
No, it's not in bad shape at all.
But I mean, there was a few rust spots that I took care of. And when I was done with it, that's pretty much what it looked like. I had the windows tinted. I didn't want quite the same sleeper look, so I did get some 24 valve badges put on the side. I found a set of cheap 2004 Ford Taurus 16-inch wheels. That's what those wheels are.
Really? Did you have them powder coated or something? Because I don't remember seeing a Ford.
I sanded them up. I polished up the lips, and then I painted them gunmetal to match the lower trim, which white, and then I had the lower trim repainted gunmetal.
Yeah.
I did repaint the side, had the windows tinted. I fixed up the interior. I won 3 trophies with that car in 2015 at car shows. I was shocked that I was winning trophies with it because it's a Sable. As you do, and by that I mean as I do, I was getting a little bored with it. I was like, this doesn't get enough attention, you know.
The way you've talked about this car, I've known you for 3 or 4 years now. I thought you owned this thing for 2 or 3 years, something like that. You talk about this thing all the time. I did not know you only owned it for a year.
I only owned it for a year. And look at that. We're looking at it here on YouTube. Look at that fabulous late 80s Mercury Sable. That's first gen Mercury Sable dash. And that was the LS. So, I mean, it had the digital climate control. Of course, in the swap, it got the show seats. It got the show console. It got the show, the 89 show instrument cluster. And I mean, everything worked great. But I was feeling like I was just a little tired of it. I wanted to get something else. So I advertised it up. And I had a person in California that was really interested in it, really in love with it, and he bought it. I met him in Denver, Colorado. I road tripped. It's about 6.5 hours down to Denver, and I road tripped it down to Denver. Met him there. There's a shot working on the engine. Yeah, man, I tore that engine. I didn't tear it completely apart, but I mean, one of the things that I've always done with the show is, okay, you got to get in there. You do the 60,000 mile service. You do the plug wells. You make sure all the seals are good. While it's out, you clean up the intake and you polish and you paint them, because I don't think there's a better looking intake that's ever been on a car ever than the 12 runner show V6 intake. But I met him in Denver and he picked up the car and he road tripped it back to California, and that was in 2015. And then, yeah, this past weekend, I think it's the Walworth fire. I apologize if I have the name wrong, but it just hit him like a ton of bricks, and he managed to get away. House was okay. He was okay. Families were okay. But the wagon is no more. It got caught in the fire and burned to a crisp. And I tell you, he gave me the news on Monday, and this is the kind of enthusiast he is, and the kind of passion that I think a lot of people in the auto enthusiast community share. Before he said anything on any like of the public forums, like some of the show Facebook groups or at showforum.com or some of the other places, he wanted to make sure all the previous owners of this car knew wow. about what happened first. So they didn't hear about it through a forum. So, I mean, he contacted me. He contacted my friend, the guy that I bought it from. I don't think either of us had the information of the engineer that built the car originally. But yeah, before he said anything, he wanted to call and let me know so I could hear it directly from him. And it was sad, man. I mean, I've owned 34 cars in my life, and there are three that I would like to have back. And that was one of them. And it even went so far. I mean, I stayed in contact with him after mm-hmm. I sold it. He would shoot me messages. He would ask me questions. And I consider him a friend. A lot of people out there that have a lot of cars that they sell. I know sometimes you sell the car and you think, I just don't want to ever see it again. That was absolutely not the case here. I loved talking to him. I loved trying to help him as he continued to work with it. And I dropped hints more than once, and I know he's going to be listening to this, and I dropped hints more than once saying, you know what, maybe I need to buy that back from you.
Yeah. You've mumbled about if it was ever available again, I would buy that again.
And so. the joke was that there was probably be three of us fighting for it. And that would be me, the friend that I bought it from, and our global editor in chief, John Neff, who had a chance to buy this car, John, but you didn't. And then realize after the fact, oh, I didn't know all about its history. Well,
yeah,
you should have looked at my ad a little closer. But yeah, three cars. That was one that I wanted back. And I'd say it's the one that I wanted back the most. So I'll never have it back. But hopefully sharing this story with everybody. I mean, this touches me in an auto enthusiast way that I think a lot of listeners out there can understand. And that's why I wanted to share it with the Rambling About Cars family. We've all had losses. We've all had cars that we would like to have back. Don't take them for granted. I shall miss that Sable show. I'm internally grateful that I had a chance to own it for a year, that I was a part of its history. I am exceptionally grateful that our friend out in California was able to get through that ordeal. Okay. There are a lot of people out there that have lost a lot more than a car.
Yeah.
And our hearts and thoughts go out to them. We gotta brighten up this ending, Bruce. You got a quick joke or something. Thank you everybody for listening for my little eulogy here on my 1987 Mercury Sable show wagon that had such an incredible history. May it live on forever.
So you know what? As you were talking about that and with the passion you were talking about, it just made me think, I know in the past couple of weeks, but especially the past couple of days, you have been kind of show shopping. You kind of want a new show in your life. So
yes, I do. I really do.
You know, drop us a line. Like, if you know a Taurus show that needs some love, the first and second gen, not the later kind of bulbous one, but
right,
just
for first and second gen. You know what? I'll bring a trailer. I'm not looking for a mint pristine car.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to have a project car because I know these cars backwards, forwards, and sideways. And part of the joy for me is bringing these cars back to life. And actually, there's one about 55 miles away from me that I just learned about this week that needs some love that I might go look at this weekend. It's a red 93 automatic, which ironically is the same kind of show that I owned for 10 years at 100,000 miles. I'm not sure I want another red 93 automatic. Really want an 89. If you have an 89 that needs some love, podcast at motorone.com. Chris.smith@motorone.com if you prefer.
And you know
Or send them to Bruce too. Bruce, I need to get somebody else addicted. This sucks, man.
After listening to all of this Taurus show love tonight, I think after you and I get off, I think I have to watch RoboCop on Blu-ray tonight because I need
No. Don't watch it. Watch The Santa Claus with Tim Allen.
Oh, does he drive one?
He has a gorgeous 89. I think it's an 89 with custom wheels on it. You're talking to the wrong person on show movies.
Huh.
Tim Allen, the Santa Claus, had a great example.
I want to watch RoboCop,
though. RoboCop kind of made the Taurus famous. For younger people that don't get it. When the Taurus and the Sable came out in the mid-80s, I mean, there was nothing like them. They were round. They looked like the freaking future.
Yeah.
The car saved Ford because Ford was in a financial... They were in some financial trouble at the time. In 1986, a lot of cars were still very boxy with the big, like, full-on halogen plug-in light.
Sealed beam headlights,
whereas this thing just had the flush lamp. Yeah, it changed everything, and it was such a big deal that, yeah, movies use them for cars of the future because they look like the future. I mean, now,
yeah, that's why RoboCop used it, is because it looked like the future of police cars. Is that was the idea that, like, this is the future of Detroit. What are they going to drive? A Taurus. Like, you say that today and like everybody laughs,
but in context back then,
it's not, you know, the way it works.
And I mean, I grew up through the 80s. I remember seeing that car come out and my first thought was, well, that almost has as much power as a Ford Mustang, as the 5.0 Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, not only did it have 220 horse versus 225 in the Mustang, it did it with two less liters of displacement, no forced induction. And unless you were in the state of California, you didn't even need any EGR system because they were that efficient. Ahead of its time, that engine. Here's to you, Sable Show. Thanks mostly to the folks at Yamaha.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's call it a night. Good afternoon, good evening, or good night. Whenever you happen to be listening to us, we always appreciate it. And again, no comments last week. Send us some comments. If you're on YouTube, comment, like, subscribe, follow, whatever you call it.
Tell us about your automotive lost love. Tell us about the cars that make you a little misty eyed.
Yep. Podcast
at MotorOne.com. Yours.
And Motor One Podcast is the YouTube. And then you can, like I said earlier, you can always find us at MotorOne.com every Friday. You'll find the post. So comment on one of those. Like, we love, honestly, getting your comments. We love reading them. So let us know. But thanks, everybody. And bye-bye.
See ya.